This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur einen Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Der Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Kapital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Kapital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there, we really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Alternative arrangements are being sought for an operation to be carried out on the victim of a suspected Republican feud last weekend after he was prevented from travelling to Scotland for surgery. The BBC understands Sean O'Reilly was shot twice in an attack in the Belsteel Manor area of Dunmurry on Sunday. Who is blocking Mr. O'Reilly from travelling to Scotland for vital surgery? And why? Mr. O'Reilly's victim of a suspected Republican feud shooting specialist surgery, which is not available in Northern Ireland, was scheduled to take place at a hospital in Glasgow. But it's now been cancelled. And we're curious about that. His solicitor is even more curious. Was speaking to Evening Extra yesterday. Peter Corrigan from Phoenix Law was talking to them. Evening Extra's Claire Graham put it to Mr. Corrigan that it's the hospital in Scotland that had refused to treat his client.
We're pursuing a judicial review. We've included...
Against who?
Against including the Trust, the PSNI, MI5... and the Scottish authorities to establish who is actually responsible for the decision not to give my client the requisite emergency medical attention that he requires. And as part of that, our case is that my client there's been a violation of his Article 3 convention rights, mm-hmm. not to be subject to inhumane and degrading treatment resulting in permanent injury. And who's responsible for that? Is it honestly the case that the PSNI and MI5 are saying that a Scottish hospital and the doctors and surgeons who have taken the Hippocratic Oath have said we're not going to give the requisite surgery to Sean O'Reilly?
Well, that's precisely what we're doing.
Totally untenable in our view.
But on what grounds have you at the moment to say that this was a decision led by MI5 or the PSNI?
Well, it's clearly a situation where we have included that we're not accepting what they're saying in that statement. We're seeking through proper legal recourse to establish who was responsible for the decision making.
So I want to be very clear about what this letter says, because I think it bears going through. The PSNI are saying that your client has been placed under armed guard for his safety since entering the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast. And then there was the request for this move to Scotland that was a consultant-to-consultant conversation. It says the PSNI contacted Police Scotland so that it could make arrangements for managing the risk to Mr. O'Reilly while in hospital in Glasgow. The PSNI did not have any contact with the hospital, it says. And it says it would appear that the management of the hospital in Glasgow had not realised there were any extra considerations to be taken into account before accepting your client into their care. Our understanding is that those in charge of the hospital are not willing to accept Mr. O'Reilly. It then goes on to say that you have previously said in the media that the air ambulance is ready, but your client was told that the authorities had refused to take him under anti-terrorism legislation, and they have given you now the opportunity to correct what they call that inaccuracy.
Yes.
That's where we find ourselves this evening. The PSNI is saying it's not us, it's the hospital, but you're insisting that actually it's the PSNI's position still? Is that what you're
saying? No, we're insisting that we're seeking through correspondence and through litigation to establish who the decision making process in this case. We need to establish that at a Scottish hospital what was said by the authorities, by maybe MI5, by whoever, that resulted in my client being denied emergency. Like, let's really look, the real issue is here. There's someone who's a victim in this, who's been shot last Saturday, who suffered sustained serious injuries, and he's been deprived requisite medical treatment.
Is there any precedent for that in your experience?
There's no precedent in relation to that. And I would urge, the time is ticking about who's responsible for the decision making. I would urge the authorities, including the Scottish authorities, to provide him with the emergency care that he needs now. There is an air ambulance waiting in the Victoria to bring him to Scotland, and I would urge the relevant authorities to give him the care that he requires and to exercise their discharge their duties under the Hippocratic Oath.
Where did the anti-terrorism notion come from, that it was anti-terrorism legislation that was the problem here?
My client was told, asked for the reasons why he was not being brought to Scotland like everyone else, and he was told that it was under the anti-terrorism legislation.
By whom?
And by a surgeon. And the other matter here too, additionally the matter, this is a clear, this decision, whoever it's been made by, is clearly an arbitrary, unlawful decision restricting his freedom of movement. There's no lawful basis to prevent my client.
Have you heard from the Greater Glasgow and Clyde NHS on this?
No, but we haven't been given the lawful basis, because there is no lawful basis. There's nothing under the Terrorism Act. There's nothing under the freedom of movement of persons. There can be nothing to stop someone getting the proper emergency care. In times of war, doctors would treat enemies in times of combat, World War II, all the major conflicts. People who are injured are treated by doctors. In the Troubles, in the 40 years of the Troubles, we have constant examples of people who are saying perpetrators and victims and all the rest, but everybody was cared for medically.
This is saying, this email, the latest email from the PSNI, saying that they are raising some of the issues here so that you have an opportunity to correct the inaccuracy, as has been reported by the BBC and others. This is the inaccuracy that he was unable to travel by air ambulance under anti-terrorism legislation. Do you want to correct that as an inaccuracy, or do you stand by that is what you claimed to have been told by a surgeon at the trust?
I was told by the client that he was told by a surgeon that it was under anti-terrorism legislation.
But you've already also said that there's no part of anti-terrorism legislation that could apply here.
None. That's the problem.
So
that's why
it can't be anti-terrorism.
It can't be under, and it can't be under any act. Can somebody in relation to it cite any lawful authority to prevent somebody getting emergency care?
So the time, from your perspective, is ticking, and you're still no clearer as to who is making the decision that your client, for all the reasons that you said, cannot be transported to the Glasgow Queen Elizabeth Hospital.
And I would urge the Glasgow Queen Elizabeth Hospital to allow him to be brought over to Glasgow and receive medical care, and he can be returned then to his family.
That was with Declan and Claire last night on Evening Extra. And here we are today, and nobody has a baldy what's going on. So we go to the police, and we ask for transparency from the PSNI. What's going on? Guess what they do? They send us to the NHS. And we go to the NHS and we have got no answers from them either. So there is a man. Is there a policy? Is there someone directing that a man is not cared for? If not, why was he not flown to that hospital? And what are we all to do? Just bury our heads in the sand and say, okay, it doesn't matter? Because if there is something going on which is preventing Mr. O'Reilly from getting care, then who else does it apply to? What are the rules of Northern Ireland all of a sudden? Why are there no clear answers? Former senior police officer John Burrows with us. And you see, John, what you're going to do is speculate. You don't know, but you're wondering what's going on here, right?
I'm wondering. I can maybe give you an informed assessment. I mean, there are some legal bases upon which you can restrict travel within the UK, but it doesn't, under anti-terrorism laws, but it doesn't seem to apply in this case because everyone's sort of agreeing that those laws aren't in place in respect of Mr. O'Reilly. If you want my best guess in this case, I would say this is some issue around bureaucracy and communication. Mr. O'Reilly is under armed guard. He's under armed guard because it was an attempted assassination, as opposed to things like punishment shootings or whatever. So when someone's under an assassination attempt, often the police will put an armed guard because they could be subject to another attempt to finish them off, if you like. So that's required Police Northern Ireland to liaise with Police Scotland to facilitate some kind of armed guard over there, I would imagine, in Scotland. And my best guess is that the hospital management have said, oh dear, we don't want this in our hospital. And someone has made a rather perverse decision. So I think it is.
And we don't know that, John. You're speculating, this is your best guess. We don't know.
Best guess. What I do know for certain, Stephen, is this. And you know, I've spoken to your program. I'm tough on terrorism. I'm opposed to the engagement with paramilitaries under this latest plan. But here's a real truth. That dissident Republicans, one of the things that they seize upon, apart from the fact we have a man here who needs treatment and should get treatment, is they look at cause celebres like this. That whenever the state is seen to be oppressive or inhumane or not compassionate or treats Irish people in Northern Ireland like second-class citizens, that actually feeds the dissident narrative. That actually increases the risk of the terrorism because it fuels that kind of grievance that the dissident Republicans will try and peddle to young people. So I think the leaders in our country, the chief constable, the political leaders, our health leaders need to get some kind of emergency conference going on here, telephone calls this morning, liaise with Police Scotland, put everyone on the same phone call. You know, my experience, that's where these things go wrong. I want Police Scotland senior officer, Police PSNI senior officer, NHS Northern Ireland and the Scottish Hospital. And we all put the facts together and we get this sorted so this man can get the treatment he needs on a humane level. But second of all, we don't feed the narrative that dissidents want to peddle.
Here's William this morning. First call of the day. Morning, William.
Hello.
Good morning. Go ahead, sir.
I'm just, I haven't heard all that John said there, but I think he said much the same as what I'm going to say. Your own newsroom announced last night, nothing to do with PSNI, MI5, anyone else. He's under guard in the Royal Victoria 24 hours a day. Police, PSNI contacted Police Scotland to get the same guard in the hospital. And when the hospital heard that, when contacted by Police Scotland, they withdrew the offer of giving him the treatment.
Well, he's giving us his view as he's entitled to. And we've asked that solicitor. We've given him an opportunity. We've reached out to Phoenix Law. And obviously, they may have got more information since last night. We'd be very interested to hear from that solicitor. Do you think Mr. O'Reilly should be treated as quickly as... Do you think he should be treated as quickly as possible, William?
No, not... If he wasn't in the IRA dissidents, he wouldn't have been shot. And I would love to know who's paying for the air ambulance, $20,000. Who's paying for that? I hope it's not the Northern Trust.
Why not?
Why not? Well, if Republicans want to be what they are, anti-British, then the avail of British chartered across to Scotland. maybe if he loses the nerve in the arm, he'll realise that he shouldn't have been involved in terrorism.
We don't know that he was involved in terrorism. So you've got to be very, very careful. Very careful indeed.
Isn't it?
Incredibly careful, just levelling something like that. And we would distance ourselves. We would distance ourselves from that type of comment. And we're going to stick to the facts this morning. John Burroughs, what's a TPIM?
Okay, well, you have what's called a TPIM. It's a temporary prevention and investigation measure. Your listeners might remember the old control orders that used to be the Secretary of State could issue that says that you couldn't move from Northern Ireland to England, and effectively it was to try and stop, if we just said as it is, Republicans potentially involved in bombing campaigns. So they were issued where they couldn't get a conviction. If there's sufficient intelligence or what's called closed material, you could apply to the court and say, we want to prevent this person moving to travelling to England. So the modern version of a TPIM is, of a control order, is a TPIM, and that's what it's called. The Secretary of State can apply for one. It's heard in the court. The person knows about it because they can make representations. And that's the only legal option I'm aware of that can stop you moving within the UK like this. But from listening to Mr. Riley's solicitor, that is not the case, that there is no TPIM in place. So, you know, it does seem to be an issue between the authorities here communicating with authorities there. And I would say three of the executive team in the Police Scotland at the minute, ACC rank and above, are actually recent were recently in the PSNI. There are three senior officers who left the PSNI. So there should be a way of sorting this out and good communication, because the last thing we want here is anyone suffering long-term damage. We need to be a humane society. You can be tough on crime, but it's humane on people. And we don't want the dissidents actually having a field day on this one either, because this feeds into this terrible narrative that the state doesn't care about you if you're a certain kind of person. So this needs sorted.
What we do know is Mr. Riley is said to be a member of Republican Network for Unity, a small political group with links to the dissident organisation ONH. We do know that.
Yeah, we know that.
He's under armed guard at the Royal Victoria Hospital for his own safety. We know that also. That's coming from BBC News Online.
Yeah, and those armed guards are you know, happen, as I say, just to explain to your listeners. So if someone was subject to an attempted assassination, if you like, by an organised crime gang or a terrorist group who are determined to murder someone, that person will then get, it's risk assessed, but invariably they will get an armed guard at the hospital. And you will have at least two police officers there who are armed, protecting that person from reprisals. And in fact, the risk can be higher to the person because, of course, they are now a witness, potentially in an attempted murder trial. So they're both an attended target of an assassination, but they're also the key witness potentially. So it's really important to protect them. And clearly there's been a conversation between PSNI and Police Scotland, that's on the record from PSNI, about managing those risks. And something has happened after that. So it really is a very unusual situation.
The hospital has now been back in touch with the Nolan Show. They've said NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde cannot discuss individual patient cases for reasons of confidentiality. Well, that's interesting in itself, isn't it? Because they can't get into the individual medical circumstances around Mr. O'Reilly, but have they not got a duty to report at least the wider understanding of what's happening here? Looks like they're not going to do so.
They're not saying it's due to anti-terrorism law and speak to someone else. You know, it does sound like it is a decision taken within the hospital management, and they've maybe made a decision that the impact in the hospital is too great. But it does seem like a perverse decision.
Here's Fred this morning. Morning, Fred.
Hello.
Morning. Go ahead, sir.
A simple suggestion would be that, why not bring the surgeon over here or else take him to a hospital in Dublin?
I think they are looking at alternatives, aren't they?
Well, I don't know.
They are.
Okay.
They've said they're looking at alternatives, but you're asking a fair question. Why could a surgeon not come here? Why can't it be done here? The solicitor's saying that Mr. Riley will lose nerves in his arm if this is not done quickly.
Right.
I'm just hearing now that they are looking at bringing the surgeon to Belfast. What is going on?
Well, I'm sure you don't know what goes on in this country.
Why will that hospital in Scotland not?
Situation.
Why will the hospital in Scotland not accept him? Why?
Well, that's their decision. It's not Andy. Here's me that decision.
Okay. Fred, thank you. John Burroughs, thank you. We'll see if we can get more information throughout the day. Obviously, we'll bring it to you. Now, yesterday on the programme, we were talking about how robots, more robots, are on their way to Stormont to take over the work, some of the work, of the lowest paid workers in Stormont, the cleaners. So no, nobody's bringing the robots in for the 80-odd grand a year special advisors. Nobody's bringing the robots in for the white-collared civil servants. It's the cleaners at the bottom of the pile who are having their work replaced with robots. Now, is that fair enough? Save money? But where's the evidence that any money's been saved at all? You were discussing this big time on Nolan yesterday, 0303 80 55 55. Could we soon see robots become a regular fixture of everyday life, not just Stormont?
Desire is irrelevant. I am a machine.
R2-D2, a pleasure to meet you. I am C-3PO, human cyborg relations.
Error. Grasshopper disassemble. Reassemble.
Huh?
Reassemble.
What are your prime directives?
Serve the public trust, protect the innocent, uphold the law.
It's potentially terrifying, this. AI expert and futurist Andrew Grill with us this morning. Morning to you, Andrew.
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. These things terrify me. The possibilities around them might excite me as well. So where are we at in terms of the capability of robots to replace, at the moment, 2025, the work of humans?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I suppose when I talk to people about this, it's something people have been wanting for a while. Any process that you can automate could be replaced by robots. And you could apply that to anything. In fact, we might touch on those consultants and civil servants because they aren't safe either. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the challenge is, will the robot do the job as well as a human? And I really feel for those cleaners because they have a real skill and they also are very visible. They help brighten up the workplace. I've seen one of these robots at a railway station in London walking across the floor. It's lifeless. I don't know it does a better job. But I think we should be aware that some of these jobs will be automated. And even Google now is developing robots that have a little bit more intelligence. So, for example, they've got a robot that if I spilt a cup of coffee on my desk, I could say to it, clean up the cup of coffee, and it would do it having never seen what's in front of me. So they're getting much smarter.
And is this rapidly developing their capability?
Well, the robots have been around for a while, and if you drive a vehicle, it's probably been processed and manufactured in some way by a robot. You all see those on production lines. I think when we look at robotics, we also need to talk about AI. And I think we've seen 10 years of innovation in just the last two. And the challenge is when you talk about AI and robotics, everything is moving so quickly. I think in the previous industrial revolutions, we had months, years, maybe decades to get used to the introduction of steam power, electricity, and the internet. What we're seeing now is everyone is jumping on the AI bandwagon. So in some ways, yes, it's really accelerating, and some of those areas we'll see in robotics. But it's cognitive work, the thinking part of our job, that we're going to see the biggest impact.
So they can think for themselves? Surely not. surely they're gathering information, and yes, it feels like they're thinking, but they're not actually thinking, Andrew, are they?
Well, they're not thinking in a traditional sense. What these robots, AI, does, it does things well at speed and scale. So, you know, someone who's cleaning up a spill of water on the floor knows exactly what to do. They put the sign out, they go and get the mop, they know how to handle that issue. A robot can be programmed in some ways to do that, but if it's been programmed with hundreds of thousands of cleaning issues and incidents, it can then learn actually how to handle that and how to mop it up. So if we had this discussion even 5 years ago, it would be quite far-fetched. I think now with what I'm seeing coming out of labs, what I'm seeing in the industry, we are now getting closer to these robots. Thinking is probably the wrong word. They are mimicking human behavior because they've seen us do it, and they're like a four-year-old. They're copying us. I'm sure if I was cleaning up a spill in Stormont and I had a four-year-old watching me, they could learn how to do that as well.
Who's controlling what they're allowed to do and what they're not?
Well, that's another really good question. I think they will be limited in what they can do because robots that I've seen, they don't move that well upstairs. They need flat surfaces. If anyone has ever played with a vacuum robot, you know that it gets stuck all the time on the rug. So they're a bit unintelligent at the moment. I think probably they're going to be given a defined limit that we're not going to get you into places that the thing might upset other humans. So I think it'll be quite limited initially. And what might happen is the powers that be might go, you know what, this may have saved us some money, but it's not doing the job. And people are complaining that the cleaning is not being done to a standard they expect. So we could see in a year's time they come back and say, let the humans take over.
Stay there for me. I want to come back with some more questions. Really interesting stuff. Andrew is the author of Digitally Curious, your guide to navigating the future of AI and all things tech. Stay with us, Andrew. We'll take the news. We'll be back in just a sec. Well, just about that last story about Mr. O'Reilly that you heard in the bulletin there, the NIO have been in touch with the Nolan Show, telling us the following. The Secretary of State and the Northern Ireland Office has had no involvement in decisions regarding the treatment of Mr. O'Reilly. So the Secretary of State hasn't been involved, the NIO hasn't been involved, the hospital won't tell us, quoting client confidentiality. What's going on? When's he going to be treated? And why did he not go to that hospital? Back to the robots, Andrew Grill with us this morning. As these robots develop, Andrew, will they be able to walk like human beings? Is that just around the corner? I've seen them walk, but will they be able to have the flexibility and the speed that human beings have? In other words, bending down into, if you're looking at cleaning, bending down into holes.
So the short answer is yes. If you look on a search engine and type in Boston Dynamics robots, for many years now, they've started to evolve, and I've seen examples where it is essentially doing backflips and lifting up boxes and what have you. But that has to be connected to an umbilical cord, and this is very unsightly, and really this is still in the lab. So it's great to see these things happening. But how it actually develops in the real life is still a way off because these things need power. They're also a little bit dangerous because imagine if the robot's going along, a human being won't bump into you, or if they do, they'll say they're sorry. So technically it's possible, but I think we have time to look at what does this mean for manual labour. As I said, the past industrial revolutions have helped prepare us. I think if you're in an industry that is at risk of being automated, now is the time, and you mentioned it, to get digitally curious, and a lot of this I discuss in my book, about how you as a consumer, you as an employee, can be the one who is ahead of the curve and doesn't get your job displaced by AI or robotics because you're prepared for it.
Well, how do you do that? How do you protect yourself from a machine that can be stronger, it's going to live forever? How do you protect yourself from it?
Well, you look at what the machine is going to do and what it can't do. So there's going to have to be someone who schedules the robots, who is going to actually plan them. I was at an event over the weekend and a client told me about their robots in their factory. They said that one day they had a robot strike. All the robots refused to work and they couldn't work out what happened. What actually happened was they all ran out of power at the same time. They all went back to their charging station and stayed there while they were charging. They thought they were on strike. So you may even have to have a union for robots who don't want to work all day every day, but you need the humans to actually understand where those robots are. So who's planning the robot play? What we will see actually is the rise of what I call cobots. You're actually going to have robots and humans. I've seen some examples, some videos where the majority of the warehouse is being serviced by a robot. But for those really hard things, you're not quite sure what goes in the box. There's a station in the middle, and the robot comes to the human, and the human fixes the problem. So there is still a place for people in manual labour, and the heavy lifting, pun intended, is done by the robots. And the humans supervise, and they help with the hard cases.
Yeah, we supervise at the moment. Of course, the doomsday scenario is that if these things develop so well, that they're supervising us.
Well, here's the thing. These robots are programmed by humans, and legislation and human ethics come in some place where, and I love this phrase, just because we can doesn't mean that we should. Here's a good example. In San Francisco, you can get into an autonomous taxi run by a company called Waymo. Everyone loves them, and there have been videos of people getting stuck. But you don't see them running around London or Belfast or Switzerland, because the humans in those countries have said, we're not ready for that yet, which makes me comfortable that there is a level of human understanding. And you'll start to see a lot of legislation. There are certain AI tools that we can't use here in the UK or Europe because of legislation where you can use them elsewhere. So I think, again, by being digitally curious, by understanding what the art of the possible is, we need to keep our politicians honest to say we don't want them to go too far. We want augmented intelligence, not artificial intelligence.
Well, yeah. And look, it sounds like I'm getting into the realm of science fiction here, but hopefully I'm not. The premise behind your safety proposition is that people won't break the law and there are no rogue states. So surely you could have a rogue state or a group of terrorists that would want to program robots to do everything that they're not allowed to do.
We have them already. If you, in years gone by, got a very badly worded phishing email with spelling mistakes, every criminal now can speak perfect Farsi, German, Russian, English, Indonesian. And so the criminals, yes, we should understand they are using these tools against us. And because it's becoming harder and harder to have physical violence and robbery, what we're seeing is people are going into the cyber criminal area. So we should expect that this could happen. And that's why we need to use AI and the technology against these other people. So yes, again, by being curious about what is the art of the possible, we can start to plan for that. And while no legislation will stop a bad actor, we need to get smarter than those bad actors by using the technology against them.
Jared's called us this morning. Go ahead, Jared.
How you doing there? I was watching a thing on Bill Gates, and he was talking about AI. He was saying the next 5 years, artificial intelligence will upend the world of work. Because he was saying it would be a lot more productive. But the next 10 years, he says, the world of work will be just turned upside down, and that some people will end up having no jobs, and some people will end up doing 2 or 3 days worth of work. But he was worried more that
only if we let them, Jared.
Than safety. So he was worried that they weren't investing more in safety of AI.
Are you worried about it?
Well, I'm nearing the end of my time and work, so I'm not too bad. But the younger ones, God bless them, that's going to be interesting.
Jared, thank you. Morning to you. We talked earlier, Andrew, about these things being able to sort of think. And of course, artificial intelligence, AI, is entering the discourse quite a lot these days. Tell us what that does, what it is.
Well, artificial intelligence, by its name, it is able to do things at speed and scale. And I'm sure many of your listeners have played with all the different AI tools, ChatGPT and all those image generations. And I think people need to play with them a bit more. Let me give you an example. I was told about a couple of friends who met at a pub for a drink, and one of them said, look, I can't stay for a second drink because I've got to do the lesson plan for my students tomorrow. And the AI friend said, no, you're staying for that second drink. We're going to put your lesson plan requirements into ChatGPT and see what it can do. And in a couple of seconds, it spat out a full lesson plan. And the teacher went, I didn't know it could do that. So I think what listeners need to do is have more of those aha moments by playing with it, understanding it isn't a threat, It actually helps them. I probably save 2 to 3 hours a day with what I'm doing in terms of research by using a tool. But then the challenge is, and you'll probably talk about this, how do we trust what's coming out of the tool? If it tells us this, do we believe it verbatim? What we do need to do is apply critical thinking. But for your caller's point of view, yes, it will change the world of work because it'll allow us to ask better, deeper questions. At the moment, we're playing with these tools using internet data we don't trust. What about using data inside an organization that we do trust and surfacing new ideas? I think all the people that are concerned about AI, once they understand the power of it to make us better humans and better thinkers, they will be much more comfortable.
How does it make us better rather than making us feel stupider, weaker?
Well, Steve, imagine being able to recall everything you've ever learned from kindergarten to the current day, knowing what you'd said, done, reflecting on moments. That's kind of what AI can do.
AI, how can it do that? How does it know what's happened to me in my life? How can it do that?
We would train it. In going forward, we would train that. I'm using it as an example of having knowledge and being able to use speed and scale to go back and do that. So an AI system, I'm just likening to the ability to have all the information. It's a bit like having a room full of PhD students who are able to answer any question about anything and have a very valid answer. And the AI, even the last 2 months, is getting smarter and smarter. So when you ask it a question a couple of months ago, it may have given a flippant answer. I now get PhD level reports generated in a couple of minutes by using these powerful AI tools.
I just wonder if, you know, struggling to answer something and having a whole diversity of intelligence isn't part of the nice bit of life. Do we really want some type of uniformity where everybody knows everything and these things are churning? Like, what value is our knowledge if everybody has it?
I want to see in my lifetime cancer cured. So let's train AI on the good of things. And so let's go back through every clinical trial and look at things that we might have missed. As humans, we can only look at things so far. Imagine if we could train AI, and this is happening at the moment, on all the deepest problems of humanity and solve them. Who wouldn't want to have a cure for cancer because we can go back and ask different questions? Are we missing something? Have we looked at something in a different way? I think if you look at AI through that prism, it becomes very powerful. Yes, there are negative things. Electricity can kill you, but most people use it for good. I think we want to harness, but it comes down to understanding what it can do. Rather than people reading about all this, they should be playing with the tools, being digitally curious and understanding what it can do for them and for society.
Now, the team here, the Nolan team, they've got a little bit excited about this, and they asked you, didn't they, to do something with AI about my voice. What did they ask you to do?
So I was talking to your producer about the ability to clone a voice, and I've cloned my voice, I've cloned my video, and I said, look, all I need is about 3 minutes of audio of you saying anything, and then I can create AI Stephen. And in about 3 minutes, I did that.
Well, let's have a listen. Good morning, everyone. Stephen Nolan here. And today I've woken up in a really good mood. I've realised that I'm incredibly lucky to be surrounded by such an amazing team. They're so patient and hardworking. I want to show them how much I believe in them by upping all their pay, no questions asked. I've also decided that I don't like crisps anymore. So if you're behind the till of a shop, make sure I don't buy any. No matter what I say, don't serve me. Who knows? I might even go vegetarian this year. Thank you all for listening, and don't forget to tune in every weekday at 9 a.m. to the biggest show in the country.
So that was a computer replicating my voice. Well, it sounded like I was down the RTE.
Well, we could actually change it. We can make you more happy, more sad. The challenge, though, is I'm sure some people thought that sounded pretty close to you. Now, your regular listeners will go, nah, that's not Stephen. He doesn't talk like that, and he does like crisps. But I'd never heard your voice before, and I got a friend of mine. I played them your actual voice and the AI voice, and they said, that's pretty close. But this actually raises a really important issue. If I can clone your voice in 3 minutes, imagine then making a recording of you asking someone for money in a panic and calling someone you care about, and then going, oh, Stephen, what's the bank account details? I'll send it to you. So what I advise everyone to do is know that this AI can be used for bad and you need a family password. You need a phrase that only the family knows. So if someone rang you in a panic asking for money or asking you to do something, you'd say, I know the, you know the family password, don't you? And it would thwart them. So we need to use old technology passphrases to thwart these cyber criminals. But it's pretty powerful, and it can be used for good. What did you think? Did it sound a bit like you?
I don't think it sounded anything like me.
We'll have to do another one then.
I think you could easily tell the difference between that and me. But that's just me. So I don't know. They took a section of yesterday's show, didn't they? The team, and they gave it to you. So let's hear how this is all the words, some of the words that I used in yesterday's program. Let's see what churned back out. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. More robots are on the way to Stormont.
To the department run by the Sinn Féin minister, John O'Dowd. So are the robots going to replace any of the work being done by the 90 grand a year special advisors?
No. How about the politicians? How about AI replacing the thinking of the politicians? Or indeed some of the researchers, sometimes
the family members
of politicians.
Are they being replaced by the
robots? Is AI going to get in there and start to reduce costs there? No.
Oh, I see what that was doing. So that's listened to what I was saying and then recreated other people's voices saying it.
Yeah, we could actually have you say it as a politician. So that's how powerful it is. Now, the voice I did that you said wasn't exactly like you, I just used 3 minutes of audio. If you actually do it seriously, it would be very hard to detect it. That was just what we call a quick clone. So
Fair enough. Here's Teresa. Morning, Teresa.
Come on, Stephen, how are you?
It's interesting, isn't it?
These robots.
Yes.
You're the GP. They're going to be your GP. How are they going to examine you? What you're complaining about? Have they got X-ray eyes or something, or what?
It's probably the doctor
examines you by feeling whatever part of your body's sore or complaining about. How would they work that out?
It's probably only a matter of time, Andrew, is it not?
But again, this is about augmenting. So GPs, I think, are one profession that is quite safe for a couple of reasons. First of all, you need to have that physical touch and everything else. But GPs are massively overworked, and when you present to them and you've got that 5 or 10 minute slot to explain what's wrong with you, they've got to, on the spot, back to my point, go back through everything they've learnt. Have they missed something? Have they missed the latest treatment? So what the NHS is using now is allowing them to actually consult an AI system to look at your symptoms and look at what that might be. Again, imagine having a room full of specialists on hand able to assess the patient. It just leverages what we can do in terms of personal care. So I don't see the GPs going away. I see them giving better care.
Here's Sammy next. Morning, Sammy. Sorry, Teresa. Morning, Sammy.
I just want to say,
Hold on, Teresa hasn't finished. Go ahead, Teresa.
These robots are getting intelligent and more intelligent. What happens if one thinks, or not think, but I'm better than you are, I'll do this job? Star Wars, you see Star Wars robots fighting other.
Yeah. Sammy, go ahead, Sammy.
Right, Stephen. AI can save Northern Ireland politicians from ever making a decision again. Everybody knows what has to be done. 30 years after the ceasefire, we shouldn't have any paramilitaries. Put it through AI and see what the computer says. We don't need all these hospitals. We don't need all these education boards. We don't need 17 or 18 housing trusts to look after housing. None of the politicians in 27 years has made a single decision that would risk 100 votes. Put it through the computer, and the computer will tell them this is what you have to do. And whenever they go to elect the electorate in 2027, if it's wrong, they can say it wasn't our fault. And instead of blaming each other, they can blame the computer. What's not to like?
What's happening? Is your house a building site?
Yeah, I work in building sites, Sammy, or Stephen, I.
Is that where you are, on a building site?
Yep. Shuttering carpenters knocking their pan in here. Mountain men from County Antrim. Working hard for a living, and the politicians have wrecked their business because we can't get planning permission because we have no sewers. 27 years waiting on somebody to say £100 a household for your water rates. We all have to pay for our water.
Andrew, let me let you go this morning. Thank you, Andrew, for talking to us, because I want to talk to Sammy here. But thank you, Andrew. Really interesting stuff. Someone in the background of the building site. Thank you, Andrew. Sammy, you see, the reality is that story needs to be pursued a lot more, like, by people like me. The fact that our infrastructure is being grounded, sometimes to a halt, because developers and businesses cannot plug into the water system. Massive issue in Northern Ireland.
You're looking in the wrong places.
Hey, he's away, talking to his workmen, not listening to me. Okay. We'll move on, shall we? 030-30-80-55-55. We have a new story this morning. The Nolan Show can reveal that this week there have been 235 patients that can't be discharged from hospitals across Northern Ireland because a suitable care home cannot be found. The Southern Trust, the Southeastern Trust, the Western Trust, described the 133 people stuck in their hospitals as having complex needs. We've been digging into this after a different family got in touch with us to tell us about their frustrations when trying to find the proper care home for their loved one.
The care home manager, and I have to say we both supported her point of view that he couldn't return there because he had a duty of care to her staff and her residents. So he ended up in a critical care ward and he's still there.
He's still in hospital.
He's still in hospital. He's been there for 4 weeks. What we want to happen is for them to find somewhere to go because of the decisions that have been made by medical staff at the Royal. He is now homeless. I think that he has deteriorated very badly since this whole episode began 4 weeks ago.
I just want to let you know that I didn't take the decision to ring the show lightly. This has that story of that other family resonates very close to home. We're in a similar position with my father, who is in a care home at the minute. So his current home have issued him on the 1st of February with notice to leave on the 28th, which is this Friday, and my father still does not have a place where to go. So they're now potentially talking about placing him in a mental health unit because they have nowhere else to put him.
How do you feel about that?
Extremely distressing for him. I feel absolutely disgusted, Stephen, and I feel let down by the whole system. And just we're desperate as a family, which is why we've had to get in touch with yourself.
Well, that was Lindsay on Tuesday. Lindsay's back with us now. What have they done, Lindsay, in between?
Good morning, Stephen. In between, since after the call on Tuesday, I received a call from the Trust to say that the immediate threat of homelessness would be gone because they were meeting with the care home that he's currently in to tell them that under contract with the Trust, they must honour that and they can't evict him until the Trust find a suitable place for him. So this morning we're sitting that we're not in that situation where he's going to be homeless today. Thankfully, he still has somewhere to stay, even though the current place he is in is still unsuitable for him, but it's still better than him having nowhere to go. So there was also a meeting held with very senior officials from the Trust and healthcare professionals. A mental health consultant was in attendance, and they on Tuesday afternoon, they agreed that the mental health unit was an unsuitable course of action for my father and that he needed to be placed in dementia residential care.
Why did it take us to be involved? Why didn't they do this after you were asking what's going to happen to my dad?
That's exactly what I would like to know. I'd been asking this question since May of 2024, and it took me to get in touch with yourselves, which I was extremely reluctant to do, to force any action. And we have now also been told just yesterday that there may be a suitable place in residential care for him.
And oh, they've suddenly come up with one, have they? That's good. Oh, but yeah, why didn't they come up with it before now?
I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't have that answer, Stephen, and I wish I did, because it would help the hundreds of other families out there that have found themselves in the same position as ourselves, because it's little comfort to families like mine to be told that, oh, you're not the only one in this situation. It doesn't provide comfort that there's over 200 people in this situation waiting like us. It actually adds to the stress and anxiety of a family to know that the situation is so bad and it's hopeless, and your only answer is to contact a show like yourself and be told that, you know, now we may have a place for him and we'll assess him, and if it's agreed, that's where he'll go. So it's just, I don't know, I don't have, as I say, I don't have the answer for you, Stephen, on
Lindsay,
that, and I wish
70,
I did, because it would help other people.
72 people are waiting in hospital in the Belfast Trust jurisdiction, that because they're waiting for a care home place. 57 in the Western Trust, 30 in the Northern Trust. The South Eastern Trust, that includes the Ulster Hospital, 44 patients sitting in a hospital because a care home bed can't be found for them.
Yeah.
And the Southern Trust, 32 people waiting. Now, I just want you all to know this as to how these trusts are behaving with you. Because when the BBC asks questions, we're not asking questions for ourselves. We're asking questions on behalf of the public. And the Belfast Trust, the Western Trust, the South Eastern Trust and the Southern Trust have failed to disclose to you the information that presumably they have as to what the longest time is that someone has been sitting in a hospital. Only the Northern Trust answered the question, telling us one patient has been waiting 117 days, which begs the question, Lindsay, are they trying to hide it from you? Or why didn't they answer the question?
I don't know why they can't answer that question, Stephen, and it's a question that I have asked. We were waiting for my father to be moved since last May, and as I said on Tuesday, his situation escalated in October time. I have asked both for figures of both, how many people were placed in the care home system from hospital, because my father was in hospital before he went into his current care home for 6 weeks. And we have asked the question, give us the figures, how many people were placed prior to my father while he was waiting from May last year. Nobody has been able to give me those figures, and it's kind of been brushed off that I haven't asked that question. But now that I don't know that my dad is definitely going to be placed in this home that has a bed available. That's not a foregone conclusion today. But we are thankful at the minute as a family that the threat of him being homeless today has gone. But it frightened me that it took me to contact your show. And I would like to call out Tommy and thank him publicly for contacting the trust on my behalf and asking what is going on here. Because if he hadn't have done that on Monday, I would still have been in a position today where I don't know. I didn't know what was happening this morning. So it took us to contact
the other part of this,
to speak on our behalf.
The other part of this story is it sounds like the trust are saying that the care home have responsibilities within their contract.
Yeah, well, I don't know the legalities of all that, Stephen, but there's a contract between the trust and each home the patients are placed into. I would imagine that every home is under contract with the trust because they have a duty of care residents placed in there.
Well, look, we'll continue to stay in touch with each other, and thank you in the meantime, and we'll try to force the information out of these trusts that they're trying not to give it to you.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Ja, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur einen Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today at 10:04. We're just in the middle of discussing this situation where hundreds of people are sitting in hospitals across Northern Ireland who should be out of those hospitals into a care home, and yet the care home places are not there. The Belfast Trust have been in touch with us to tell us that they're working as hard as they can to get us the information around the longest waiting time for an individual in under their care that have been stuck in a hospital. So to be fair to the Belfast Trust, they have come back to us to say they're doing that. Southern Trust, Southeastern Trust, Western Trust haven't. Let's see what goes on there. I've been speaking to Pauline Shepherd, the CEO of the Independent Health and Care Providers Association, for her reaction.
Well, really, Stephen, I mean, these stories are really very distressing. Anybody that's in hospital waiting to be discharged, unable to be discharged, it's very challenging for them to remain in hospital. So waiting for a care home bed, unfortunately, isn't, you know, that uncommon. There's many difficulties around it. Well, first one being that it's patient choice. I mean, not everything matches. Might look to match on paper that you've, say, 20 discharges and 20 beds available, but they might not be in the right area. Beds in care homes are registered for particular types of care, so you can't just allocate to any bed, you know, for the next person that comes along. So it's multi-layered and complex in managing discharges from hospital.
Well, multi-layered and complex, but is this affecting lots of different people? Is there a crisis?
Well, it's always affected lots of people. We have always difficulty in discharges from hospital, mostly in the winter. But, you know, throughout the year, I think it is becoming more of a problem because we are seeing that there are many more people being discharged from hospital with complex needs. Maybe they're being assessed as requiring one-to-one care or maybe requiring two-to-one care. And, you know, a hospital will maybe assess them as that, but a care home is unable maybe to accept a resident with that amount of care required if they don't have, you know, they don't feel it's safe to accept them in their care home. The main thing that a care home provider will consider is it safe? Can we deliver safe care when we accept this person into our care? And we are finding that there's more complex assessments coming through.
We sometimes hear of dementia beds. What is a dementia bed?
Well, really, you know, all care home beds across Northern Ireland are registered under particular categories. There's probably around, I think there's about 10 or 12 categories. So, you know, they're registered with the RQIA, and the RQIA would monitor that it's only those beds that are being used for types of, you know, person that are within that category of care. So you cannot accept a dementia patient from hospital into, say, a frail elderly bed or a mental health bed or other beds that are designated for other things. And that's about keeping people safe within the, you know, the lines of control and the lines of care that are monitored. So it is every bed is registered. So it's not a matter of anybody can go to any bed.
As we look across the different trusts here, the Northern Trust, 30 patients in an acute hospital delayed awaiting a permanent care home bed. The Southern Trust, 32 people with complex care needs waiting in an acute hospital for a care home bed. The Western Trust, 57 people waiting in an acute hospital for a care home bed.
Yes, and that does not surprise me. I mean, that picture's fluid every day. I mean, if you take a
72 in Belfast Trust, 72.
That's a snapshot on a particular day, but doesn't surprise me. But a snapshot also on a particular day when you look at care homes accepting people from hospital would be that, I mean, for instance, yesterday I was speaking to a care home group that was actually ready to accept 20 people from hospital into their care homes across Northern Ireland. They had another 21 assessments ready to do. So it's a fluid picture. People continue to move. I think the issue for me, Stephen, is more about are there people in that those numbers that have been there for weeks, for months, whatever, waiting for a packet or waiting for a care home or waiting for a home care package? Those are the really difficult and challenging issues, those people that are waiting for long periods of time. So it is a fluid picture. If you took that same information and gleaned it tomorrow, it may similar numbers may be similar, but they're different people within those numbers. So it is a moving picture.
just looking at, again, some of the data when you say that. So in terms of how long people have been waiting, total days that four patients have been delayed, 175 days. Longest patient waiting has waited 117 days in the Northern Trust for a care bed.
And that could well be that those are the people that I'm talking about that are at complex care and that are very difficult to place. I mean, the priority for a care home is actually to say, can we accept this person, deliver care to them safely and manage them safely within the environment we have, that we protect other residents and our staff. And we are seeing more people being assessed from hospital, perhaps with behavioural issues, perhaps displaying aggression. And those are the ones, they're the challenging ones. We're finding that more and more. And you'll realise that, I mean, care homes have in the last few years adopted, a number of care home owners have built specialist mental health units to accept people who have very complex and maybe behavioural issues. And as a result of Muckamore Abbey, well, there are people who are now being placed into care homes who probably would have been maybe kept within a hospital setting previously. So the care homes are adapting to that. My issue in this is that, Stephen, I mean, we're seeing this more and more. We have an ageing population. The population's growing. It's getting more complex in terms of its care needs. We're seeing people that are maybe have dementia but also have cancer. All of these things are adding up, and I feel that we need to have a strategy in Northern Ireland that looks at, well, what do we need in the next 5, 10, 15 years? What's the ageing profile going to look like, and what way is it going to present in terms of care needs? I believe this will continue to happen because we do have a system that's built around what the care needs were 5, 10, 15 years ago, but we do need to be thinking into the future, and we are seeing those complex and challenging cases coming through where a care bed is not available for them. And I do think that is an issue, and it's a problem going forward.
Tell you what else is an issue. These hospital trusts not giving the public information that when there are fair questions, the Belfast Trust are hiding in terms of they haven't answered the question. They were asked a straight question. What is the longest waiting time that someone has been waiting for a bed, and the Belfast Trust duck and dive in their response and don't address it. Nor does the Western Trust. They duck it as well. So why would they do this? Southern Trust, I don't know, have they all been talking to each other? They don't answer it either as to the longest wait time that members of the public, if they don't give us it, we'll squeeze it out of them through FOI. And why are we needing to do that? To be fair to the Northern Trust, they've answered the question. Our longest patient waiting has waited 117 days, says the Northern Trust.
I fully understand your frustration. I have the same frustration on a daily basis, because unless we can get the data and unless we can get the information and work closely together with it, you know, that's only then that we can resolve the problems. I mean, I continually deal with the department and with the SPPG, the Strategic Planning and Performance Group. And, you know, it's a very large machine. We have five trusts, each of them doing different things. And I continue to ask, can we consolidate? Can we standardise? Can we all do things together? You know, this information you've got, I don't get that information unless I ask for it. I have to ask for it in a particular way. And on many occasions, I only get information because I ask for FOIs as well. So, you know, although we're working together, it's a very complex and challenging and frustrating issue to solve. There's so many moving parts in it. And IHCP, we are a small cog in this wheel. And we are fighting and trying to get to resolve problems. Just as you say, your frustration, I feel the same.
The Southern Trust are at it as well. Like, they know what we've asked. And they're deliberately not answering the question. So, to the Southern Trust this morning, the Southeastern Trust, the Western Trust and the Belfast Trust, we will go back again, we will ask the question again. If it's not answered, we will contact the Health Minister and ask Mike Nesbitt if he can get any of this information to the public. And the question is, why aren't they answering it, Pauline? why aren't they coming clean about how long people are waiting for beds? Why have they ducked it? That's what I'm curious about.
Well, I would be keen to see the same questions answered. Because, I mean, quite often when the hospitals come under pressure, I receive telephone calls asking, well, we're under pressure. Can you please, you know, contact your members and see about hospital discharges? Can we, you know, discharge more people more quickly? But when I ask for data, I don't get the data either. So I can't understand that. I mean, the trust themselves or the department or SPPG would have to answer that question for you.
Okay.
But yes, I'm sure there are people sitting in hospitals for many, many days, many weeks waiting on a care home. And as I've said, it could be care home of choice, that they're waiting for the care home of choice, which is their prerogative. It could be that it's not the right bed available for them in the right area. Or it could be that the assessment, it's just a care home can't be found because of the complex needs, possibly behavioural issues or aggression, and they just can't find a place to accommodate them.
Pauline, thanks for talking to us this morning. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephen.
We recorded that interview before 9 o'clock this morning, but the Belfast Trust, wait for this, they have just been back to us, so it's not about them coming clean. They say they don't have it. So the Belfast Trust have just told us a matter of seconds ago that they would have to do a manual trawl. In other words, what? They don't know how long someone is sitting stuck in a hospital? Might that person not need extra care, extra psychological help if there's someone in there for a long, long time? They don't have that information easily identifiable. That's what they've just told us. It would be a manual trawl, and so they can tell us nothing. Is that why these other trusts have ducked answering the question? And how is that a way to treat anybody stuck in a hospital? The Belfast Trust telling us a manual trawl would be required? So there's no red alerts or warning systems if someone's been left there? Is that the case? We'll have to follow this up. Next week. You're calling us today. Linda. Morning, Linda.
Good morning, Stephen.
And this is a familiar story to you, Linda.
Yes, I just heard someone say earlier that their relative had been in hospital for 4 weeks awaiting a care home placement. My mum is now in her 8th month of waiting for a care home placement. Yeah.
She's not in hospital 8 months.
She's in the Royal Victoria Hospital, and she's been there for 8 months. 7 of those, you know, would be waiting for the bed. Roughly. We're just talking rough numbers here.
Linda, I'm nearly falling off my seat.
Yeah.
Your mother is able to leave hospital and has been waiting on a bed for 8 months.
Well, a month of that, we'd take off a month, but 7 months ready for discharge. She had a stroke, and with that she has episodes of delirium and dementia. She is one of these people with the complex needs, and for that reason keeps getting turned down from care home placements. We're looking at 30 care homes at the minute with refusals to take her.
I'm nearly falling off my seat. How old is she?
Well, she's 90, but she's a really good 90. And she walks about. It's just the effect on her brain that's the problem. She was completely independent until the day of her stroke, and she's just now, this is her life for now.
Her life is stuck in a hospital when she should be out of it.
Yeah, and sort of like confined to the ward, you know, and not allowed out and stuff, obviously for health and safety. She has a one-to-one person with her all the time because of falls risks. And that's part of the problem in getting her placed in a suitable care home.
My goodness. I'm stunned. And in a suitable care home, you know, a proper care home would have all different programs in place to keep your mum stimulated, to keep her mind active. A proper care home would understand the specialities needed and the dangers associated with someone feeling isolated. A special care home would want to make your mum feel that that's her home.
Yeah, and she
and
they've
left her
really
7 months in a hospital where people will, by the very nature of it, be coming and going.
Yes, but it's also the fact that of the bed blocking issue as well. You know, it's wider than even just my mum. But, you know, when she finally gets a suitable place, you know, it hopefully would settle her down and she will, you know, she'll be better with the behaviours and stuff. But, I mean, I've been working on this for months and months. I've gone out and I found beds myself and found a lot of suitable beds that initially weren't available. But when it comes to them doing the assessment, they say no. At the minute,
why do they say no? Why do
they
do that?
Because of her needs, because of her complex needs. So basically, the way my sister phrases this is, nobody wants to take my mother because she's going to be too difficult. And I sort of look at it as my mother has needs. She has complex needs. And because of those needs, she can't get a care placement. And, I mean, there are no words for that. Saying that now, at the minute, because I'm working and we have regular meetings with the team in the hospital, they've made me aware of a complex discharge team. And at the minute, there's a possibility of her being next on a list for a bed. But that's just come to the fore this week. Whether that will when that will happen, I don't know. But it was really just I wanted you to know about the length of time.
My goodness,
she's been
and do
there.
You think the length of time has had a detrimental effect on your mum? Can you see it or feel it?
Well, I can't say categorically, but I do feel that. You know, if she had more freedom to go about rather than just being in a ward environment and was settled and could socialise with people because that's how she is, you know, that would definitely be good for her mental health.
It's quite outrageous.
Well,
how can it not be outrageous asking someone, requiring someone because the system can't find a suitable place for them? And we all pay our taxes. You paid them, your mum paid them, I pay them. It's actually quite outrageous that a 90-year-old woman they've left stuck in hospital for 7 months.
Well, that's my mum's not the only one either. You know, but obviously it's my mum that I'm trying to advocate for. I've written to the health department.
You had a response?
I did get a response, but it was really just an acknowledgement of the things that I had said and that it was the trust's responsibility. So it sort of put me back to, you know, I'm not wanting to make a formal complaint. This is where I'm coming from because I've got, with the different meetings and chats, I've come to the understanding that, in my opinion, the trust were doing what they could. Yeah. I sort of thought that the issue lay within the care homes. So I really, you know, at this stage, I'm not too sure who or what is responsible.
Well, has the minister looked at the contracts that these care homes have? Has the, you know, does there need to be new rules of engagement with these care homes that they just can't pick and choose if they're going to get any public money for looking after people, that they just can't pick and choose who they decide, no, leave that woman there. We don't want her. Too much hassle.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. I don't think that exists. For me, that is central. That's the central problem.
Will you let us know next week if your mum gets out?
I don't think she'll get out next week, but I will let you know. I don't hold out hope for a quick exit, but I will keep in touch.
Has your mum raised this with you?
No, my mum has no mental capacity because of the stroke and the delirium. So she's under the doll thing that they have and the no mental capacity. So she's not able to do anything, which is even more upsetting.
You can stay in touch with us, will you, please?
I will, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks for getting in touch with us this morning.
Okay. Thanks a million. Bye.
The Southern Trust or Southeastern Trust? Oh, the Southeastern Trust have suddenly found the data, and they say that the longest wait for an appropriate care home place is 51 days. So 51 days in the Southeastern Trust, at least we're starting to get the information now, 7 months, 210 days in the Belfast Trust. My goodness. Now, payday for many millions today, but a number of major banks have confirmed this morning that they're having issues with their online banking system. Will Guyot is a tech journalist. What's happening, Will? Good morning.
Yes, Stephen, this is one of those examples of when something like this happens, when you really need it and the reliance on something. And you've had four separate online banking apps fall over today. Most of them are related to the Lloyds Banking Group, but you've also got TSB as well. Now, on the balance of this, I reckon there's a shared service between all of those apps that has gone wrong. Now, whether that's a third party or something that's owned by Lloyds that they've also let TSB use, because they used to be, TSB Bank used to be part of Lloyds, it will be interesting to see. But many, many legacy systems, old stuff runs these banks in terms of tech. So that's why we're seeing all of these outages, because it's just not sexy for banks to invest money in IT equipment.
And so what's the net result today? I'm only hearing about this now, speaking to you. People can't get their money out or what?
Yeah, you can't access online services. You can't transfer money. You can't make online payments. You can't see whether or not you've been paid, for example. So you've got a trek to the branch. But the reality where I am in you know, mainland UK, the nearest branch now is 12 miles from where I live because they've all closed down.
Here's a statement just into us from Lloyds Bank. They say, we know some customers are having issues with internet banking and our apps. We're sorry about this. We're working to have it back as soon as possible. We do have some background briefing. Apparently, the app is not down. Users are not locked out. The briefing is that the app is working, but some customers are experiencing slow responses from it that may delay their logging in. This is
which
from
is the
Lloyds
same thing.
Banking group.
Yeah, them saying you're getting slow access to an app is splitting hairs. Your listeners will not be able to access their money as a result of this, or it may take a prolonged period of time. But their definition of down to the reality of the version where people have made requests and they repeatedly fail, the net result, the end result is identical. The bank itself is going to want to pride itself on its online service and not trick itself or its shareholders into a position where it feels it hasn't had another IT failure. But the evidence points that they're having an IT failure. There's lots of speculation online, on Twitter, etc. at the moment, that this is a result of a hack or something like that. I don't believe it is. I believe this is a really old, creaky system or a service provided by a third party that has gone wrong. And somebody's either switching it off and switching it on again, or they're having problems getting it reconnected to the system.
So what do people do? They can't do anything. They've got to wait, right?
Yeah, that's the challenge. And when you get a guidance like that, that people aren't experiencing problems, that is just not the reality. Just take one look at social media right now and you'll see that there are tens of thousands of people trying to get access to their money across multiple banks and failing. They can't transfer money to other people. Maybe they've borrowed some money from a member of the family and promised it back today on payday. That sort of stuff isn't happening unless you're going into a branch. And like I said, many of us don't live that close to a branch anymore.
Listen, Guy, thank you very much indeed. Thanks for talking to us this morning. That's it from us for today and indeed this week. Unless you follow me on 5Live, you listen to me there, where we'll start at 10 o'clock tonight. Across the UK's Nolan Show is on Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights on 5Live. See you back here, BBC Radio Ulster, on Monday morning at 9 o'clock. Have a good weekend and thanks very much for listening and calling. See you Monday.
biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.